Hi, this is Jessica Murray, Managing Editor for Stairway to STEM. We're an online resource that supports autistic students transitioning to college, especially with a STEM focus. This past April, we decided to kick off the Steps to Autism Acceptance podcast. We wanted to give our editorial board members a chance to promote concrete actions that people can take to build not just awareness, but greater acceptance for autistic students and students on the spectrum. What does it mean to really accept someone else as they are? We're going to explore the steps we can take now to create a culture change. In this episode, editorial board member Ariane Garcia and contributor Katie Matthews discuss communication differences between autistic and allistic people and how to bridge that gap. And now I'm going to turn it over to Ariane and Katie, who are going to jump right into this terrific conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, we had been talking a lot in a blog about perspective taking skills and kind of thinking about theory of mind skills and a little bit about, I don't want to say maybe controversy around those terms, but kind of thinking about the way the world thinks about those terms when it comes to people with autism and branching into how do we actually go about thinking about communication between people with autism and people without autism. And we thought maybe it'd be good to have a conversation around, you know, how to help autistic students learn social routines, but then also thinking about, well, you know, how much should we be teaching social routines and what, you know, what's the discussion around that area, especially as I think it's kind of a hot topic right now.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. One of the things that I find is really interesting about learning social scenarios is once you know, like, what to expect, it makes it a lot easier. Like, for example, if you are going to the bank and you know that you're depositing a check and that's all that's going to happen, you can expect an outcome of that and that there's no anxiety around that as long as you know what's going on. And it's the same thing for autistic people. The only difference about that is, you know, like if there are other factors that come into play, like if I go into the bank and I'm having a light sensitivity day, or I forgot my tinted glasses, or maybe there's loud noises, or somebody has their kids, that creates anxiety in me. Sensory disruptions and sensory overload, it feels the same as if I was, you know, approaching a social situation uncertain. And if I'm not careful, I can unintentionally influence those conversations. And if I'm in a situation where I'm at the financial mercy of the teller, you know, for like if they want to decide to uphold some arbitrary rule, or if they decide they don't want to talk to me anymore, and so they go and get someone else. I just think that part of learning social skills is based more off of like a psychiatry point of view, like in Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Like, oh no, you need social situation. Like, you need friends. Like, yes, I'm aware. I need friends. You know, I know being, you know, social skills are going to help me have friends, but I don't want to be anxious at the bank. I want to be able to have confidence in life skills, and I just don't see that enough. Like, I see more research, more money, more awareness, more attention to aspects of how to help them deal with other people that make other people feel comfortable, whether it be like, if it's genetic, then finding a way to get rid of the gene. If it's like medicine, a cure, you know, you always see those cures, and cure is such a strong word. It stirs up strong emotions in autistic people because, I mean, I don't know anything else other than being autistic. Before there was a word for it, I was just weird. Once I had a word for it, people who were trying to figure me out based off of those cues that people incorporate in social skills training, once they realized I was autistic, it changed things for them and how they communicated with me. And those are the kinds of things that neurotypical people don't take into consideration. And that's one of the biggest problems in this, like, you know, magnified little area where there's a clashing between autistic adults and parents with autistic kids. We don't agree on everything, and both sides have strong feelings. And really, you know, like at the basis of it, you know, we want to learn from each other and teach each other. And it can get really difficult. because on the one hand, you know, we see things that neurotypical people don't. On the other hand, there's more neurotypical people than there are autistic people. So there has to be room for compromise.
I do agree. Like, I wouldn't be a proponent of a therapy like an ABA therapy, which I think is kind of like, oh, here we'll practice this scenario over and over again. And like you said, it's just not natural. And it's also unlikely that it's going to go exactly like this practiced exact routine. Like, that's not how life works. Yeah. And then the clinic I work at, when we are working on social language, a lot of it is in a naturalistic environment. The kids are coming in and out of these gym spaces. They're playing with peers. And we're kind of focusing on skills like empathizing with someone. We're thinking about theory of mind, like reading nonverbal cues, you know, advocating for your own sensory needs. And that's for people with autism and for people who don't have autism and all, just any person, just advocating for when, like, oh, I need some space. Like, that's a skill that we all could use, I think, more of in our world. And it, like you said, it's a little bit stigmatized if someone's having a breakdown and, you know, maybe they just had a rough day. Maybe they just need some space. Mm-hmm. And kind of knowing when you can ask for that. And though, and like you said, the communication partner needs to be sensitive of that in who they're communicating with in both ends. So I like what you're saying about collaborating and learning from each other, because autistic people can certainly be teaching the neurotypical people a lot. And yeah, usually the neurotypical person is the language therapist or, you know, fill in the blank of whatever type of therapy a parent might put their child in. But I completely agree that I'm learning more from the people I'm working with than maybe they're learning from me half the time. And I'm looking at some of the questions that we had kind of talked about. And I kind of wanted to go back to when you were talking about if, you know, you're learning nonverbal skills. You were talking a little bit earlier about how that might feel really good at first for someone, but then eventually it could lead to burnout. And I would like to kind of dive into that and hear your perspective.
The part where the burnout comes in is the masking. So when I was learning nonverbal communication, it was on a level where people would tell me, because I would ask, I'm like, why are you making a face at me? And so I would just get frustrated, like, you know, and when I was younger, I thought that stuff was on purpose. You know what I mean? That's a huge thing with nonverbal communication, is that your understanding of it changes over time. You know, another example is it took me a few years to figure out when winking was acceptable. And it turns out that's not really. So, but like I tried it out in a few different conversations, you know what I mean? And I don't talk to those people anymore. So it makes you emotional. Well, when the emotional parts of your brain are firing, they're going to fire at the line of thought that's trying to get to the desired outcome of the conversation, because people don't just talk just to talk. There's an outcome. There's a reason. There's a motivation. So you're getting, you know, internally getting electrocuted all the way down the way to the end of the outcome, and it's distracting. Over time, your corrections, your on-the-toe corrections create this mask. And it's commonly referred to, you know, as masking, because it's fake. You know, you're like, oh, yeah, I'm clever. I meant to do that. You know, that's a thing I did. But, you know, really, I'm just like, okay, you know, that was a freebie. At first, you know, it feels great because, you know, oh, look, I'm on my feet. Like, I feel good, you know, you feel good about yourself that you were able to guess that quickly. And then eventually, like, if especially if you have to keep the mask up, you know, and you're feeling this on the inside, it's emotionally draining and it starts to spiral downward. Like when I get close to burnout, little routines start to go. It's super important to be aware of, you know, one's own limitations, because I know once I reach that point, like, okay, like I need to take some kind of break. whether it's like, you know, take a day where I don't talk to anyone or where I sleep all day, just whatever I need to do. If I need to take a few days, if something's going on for a super long time, like the, you know, when the government shut down, how long that lasted, like I was like freaking out the whole time. I needed like a week to recuperate when the government came back up, you know what I mean? But I couldn't recuperate until the government came back up because that was my primary stressor.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point with like thinking about when you go into that high stress brain and, you know, it's your amygdala brain and you're in that fear response and your emotions are driving your thought process. That's not a time to work on higher level language. And I see that often with families who a parent maybe who doesn't get it might say, well, they need to come to therapy. They need to do this. They need to do that. And sometimes I'm, you know, friendly with the autistic student and I've gotten to know them and who they are. And I'm advocating saying, you know, he's got a lot on his plate and coming to therapy for 3 hours a week might be better served having some time in his bed reading his favorite comic book. Like that might be what he needs. And it's hard. It's really hard to get that message across to just let. And I don't think that's necessarily even for autism. I think that's a potentially something to go into like further parenting theory, but you know, knowing when to take time for self-care. And I know we've talked about that before. But at that point, when you're drained and tired and you're having these hard emotions, it's not going to be a time where you're going to be in tune with the social nuances of a conversation. And that's not a realistic expectation that we should be having as a society. And, you know, it's the same with, you know, with anyone really. When anyone's having a really rough day, like how can we be better communication partners and stop thinking about ourselves, but start thinking about the other person and kind of how can we try to listen and support versus going into that fixing mode or the shaming mode, which would be toxic, but even trying to be a fixer before it's time to fix.
Yeah.
So another thing I wanted to bring up that we spoke about was, so say you are having a communication breakdown and you're realizing it in the moment, like, okay, this isn't working. Like something's getting lost in translation. And maybe this is someone you have to speak to again and again, like say it's a coworker or say it's a professor or, you know, even a aunt. Some of the strategies that I try to teach is like you mentioned with asking about the like, why is your face like that? Or like, why are you making that sigh? Like kind of realizing when you're not understanding something. And I always hope that autistic students will advocate for like, wait, hold on a second, I missed that. And that's for anybody who's misses anything in a conversation, like letting someone know that you're having a miscommunication. And then kind of advocating a position of someone's in power over you, advocating for maybe disclosing diagnosis and saying, you know, that means that I might not always get these nonverbal communication, or, oh, I might have more trouble with the subtleties of language, or, oh, I might have trouble with these like figures of speech or sarcastic emails, and just kind of give them a heads up so that maybe they'll have that in their mind if there is a communication breakdown. And then another one is advocating for the type of communication style that you prefer. So as you said that you used to like being on the phone more because then there wasn't these distractions, but you know, now you're kind of changed and sometimes you prefer to be in person or on video, and kind of just letting someone know that. So like, oh, I'd prefer if we could get these meeting notes in an email later, because you know that during the meeting a lot of it is just going to be maybe too much or it's too fast or whatever, fill in the blank. But advocating for another way the same material can be communicated, I think can be a really helpful tool for an autistic person to have. What other tips do you have? Or like maybe thinking about social conversations that go awry, like what could happen in those from your perspective?
I agree that sometimes you just have to disclose, especially if it's one of those situations where it will be helpful in the understanding. Like if someone's getting frustrated because they keep having to repeat themselves, you know, then I'm just like, look, I'm sorry, you know, I'm autistic, I promise I'm trying. And that,
but you don't even have to apologize. You shouldn't have to apologize. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's also a learned thing, is that, you know, I've, and like society has taught me that I had to, and that's a tough thing to unlearn. That's part of, that's also part of mental health, and, you know, part of the parent aspect is that, you know, there's things that we have to unlearn, and apologizing for being autistic is something that I'm still trying to unlearn because you're right. I shouldn't have to. And I find myself doing it a lot because, you know, like apologizing for inconveniencing the other person, because that's what, you know, that's what society has made me feel like.
Yeah. I mean, that sucks. That's like a lot of times I just hear women in general apologizing. So you got both going, but you don't need to apologize.
And race too. I have to apologize when it comes to race. That affects my experience with autism as well, especially if there's like nonverbal subtleties. I was in Ohio and I went to a little nail salon. I went inside, you know, and they looked me up and down, and I told them, you know, what I wanted. And they told me, okay, go ahead and, you know, sit in that chair. And I was sitting in the chair for 30 minutes. And, you know, after maybe like 15, 20 minutes, I looked around the room and I noticed that people who had showed up after me were getting helped before me. And I was the only Hispanic person in there. That was something I had to think about, because I was like, is this like a race thing? Like, what's going on? Like, maybe these ladies just do hands. You know what I mean? Trying to think maybe there's an excuse, because that is what society has taught me. But no, that was race. That was a race thing, because at that time, and even now, there is really negative rhetoric around brown people and, you know, like people of color. And I say brown people because I'm brown, but, you know, people of color. And that's important to acknowledge with autism, because if you look up Hispanics and autism, you only really find me and a couple of studies. There's not really a whole lot out there. One of the things that you find is that is a study trying to figure out why there are less Hispanic diagnoses. And that's because of the language of the questionnaires. It's the subtleties of conversation. The things that white people worry about that Hispanic people don't worry about. Like Hispanic people, we don't really like care so much. Whenever like our kids like take forever to talk, you know, like that's not something that's super important to us, because bilingual children take longer to talk. That's just a given. And in that aspect, you know, like that's not really a reliable thing to go off of. So whenever they give the questionnaire, they ask the parents, like, are you concerned about delay in speaking? They're like, no, the kid's only like two. You know what I mean? Like, what do they know about words? You know what I mean?
Well, it shouldn't be that much of a delay for learning both. I mean, I do know that it sometimes happens, but it's interesting that you bring up the difference of, you know, what's just expected in a culture. I mean, there's definitely a lot of pressure on mom. Well, I should say just families in general, like, oh, when is your kid saying your first words? And like, when, like, have they done this? Have they done that? And just the whole milestone propaganda, I would call it. But that's interesting that you've noticed that difference from being part of that community. Because my hope for therapy is that, like, say I'm working with a young child. Sure, the child will learn some social skills. Yeah, we'll help them develop their language. Okay, sure, we'll help them with joint attention. Okay, we can work on play skills. But honestly, the biggest thing, and a lot of research is showing, the biggest predictor of success is, and I'm saying success not in terms of necessarily academics or some, you know, hitting some milestone, but success as in the person is living a satisfied, fulfilled life later on, and they're reporting those things. And the biggest predictor, you know, is really going back to the family and educating the family and thinking about what language can the family use at home. And it's not necessarily even just language to facilitate lengthier sentences or more complex vocabulary, but language around problem solving and language around self-advocating and language around, you know, oh, how am I going to cope with this emotion or this feeling? And it's interesting because that's new for a lot of families, because as you said, you know, in so many cultures, that's just not part of the conversation. I mean, I'm from a Caucasian white family, and you know, that wasn't really the way we were brought up either, just because, you know, I was raised in the 90s and it was kind of, you know, you're doing this because I said so, and so on and so forth. And it wasn't a lot of talk about oh, wow, I see you're feeling really upset. It looks like you might need to take some time to calm down. What can I do to help? You know, and that language, I think, can be helpful in both help co-regulate the child back to being in that regulated state that they can then be ready to learn again, but then B, providing an example of that nonverbal language. So the kid sees, oh, mom's face looks like that. Oh, now she's putting the vocab to it. She's saying, you know, I'm feeling upset, I'm feeling frustrated. And then maybe she's even saying why, like, oh, I'm so frustrated because I just burned the chicken or whatever. And then if you can go one step further and they can talk about how they're now going to problem solve that moment, that's such a rich learning experience for the child. And you can look at that later and say, wow, I just taught my child social language, but it's a little bit hidden. Maybe people don't even realize that, you know, kids are sponges and they're learning all the time. Yeah. And so that would be for me, like, the way to really go about this, like, helping with some of the social language. And I think, like I said earlier, it's not just for autistic people. It could be so helpful for so many people.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is really great when you're first getting into, like, self-advocating, I know for me it took some time because I had already had decided I was just weird, and then, you know, once I had a word for it, it just, you know, everything just kind of changed. So for example, I wear tinted glasses at work because it's really bright. I've been working since I was 16, so I've always been under fluorescent lighting. I just got this note from my doctor saying that I was allowed to wear tinted glasses inside for light sensitivity just a couple of years ago. But it has, like, completely changed the way I work. That made me feel really good about self-advocating was that I noticed changes right away. And it made me feel empowered. And it made me feel confident. I felt like whenever I was verbalizing how I felt and I was understood and respected, everything went great. And then where I ran into problems was not knowing the words for how I felt and just knowing that I was upset. And the way a conversation goes is when you announce that you're upset, you know, the other person says, well, why are you upset? A dialogue is started. But if you don't know why you're upset, then your answer is just, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That can go so many different ways. That can go, okay, well, I'll give you some space. That can go like, okay, do you want to talk about it? That can go immediately into like, well, like, is it physical? Is it emotional? You know what I mean? Like, depending on the person, they may back off, or they may instantly go into problem solving mode. Like, learning to self-advocate is just learning when to realize that, just give me a minute. Like, I can tell that you guys can tell that I'm upset, but I'm not really ready to talk about it. You know, I just kind of want to keep it on the down low, and let's all just kind of carry on while I think about this. And then if I can figure it out or what have you, then we can talk about it at a different time.
Mm-hmm.
What are some tips for family members who, like, want to help change their communication styles to be more accessible, or like what kind of is that part of, like, do you have any therapies that might help, since ABA is really controversial?
Sure. Yeah, I think in terms of types of therapy, I personally like to go with a more naturalistic approaches, which would kind of be for young kids, like the floor time model, or, you know, like anything that's like a play-based DIR, that would stand for developmental and individual differences relationship therapy. And those types are usually highly focused on how the parent kind of engages and interacts with the child, and then how the child interacts with their world. And it's child-led, which that's kind of a key for me when it comes to young kiddos in treatment. And I think that anything that's kind of attachment-focused therapy, so if you're looking at a center and you either see that they're attachment-focused or sometimes sold as like a trauma-informed care model, but those are usually kind of person first places that I really like. And then also if the clinic has a sensory integration lens on it, that's usually helpful because that gets into them being aware of some of those things you were talking about with, you know, noise sensitivity or light sensitivity. And you need to think about those things before I think you can talk about subtleties of communication. A lot of parents will get the option of receiving therapy through the public school system. And I think just having a strong conversation and dialogue with this particular therapist and asking them, like, what is the therapy like? Like, who's in their social group? Because social skills groups are just so different. It could be great. It could not be great. So you really need to ask the questions and kind of figure out what's really going on there. And if there's that lens of kind of, I would say, emotional intelligence training within it, so that it's not just about, well, how am I going to communicate, but it's also about how am I going to react to different things. And like, you can only really control your own emotions and your own reactions. So giving the skills and building that toolbox so that when there's a miscommunication, or when you're feeling frustrated, or when you're not getting your needs met, it doesn't have to be a big blow up. It can be something that feels more controlled and feels like you're empowered, and that you're like, okay, this is something I know I can take control of, and I can use these tools that I have. And maybe that tool is that you just need some space, and maybe that tool is I need to go tell an adult about XYZ. But it won't be helplessness, you know?
Yeah.
And that I think is really valuable, because the parent's not always going to be there. You asked about what ways a family can kind of help.
With their communication styles, to be more accessible. Are there any just tips in general?
Yeah, sure. Like I was giving the example before about narrating your own, the way that you communicate with other people.
Yeah,
can be huge. So I love to use the examples, like children and even young, you know, preteens love a good story, or even high schoolers, anyone really loves a good story. And if you can kind of teach through these like social stories about yourself, that can be really powerful. So instead of, you know, you see your child is upset and you're like, why are they upset? What's going on? Instead of going hard with the questions, talking about yourself and making a story of like, oh man, I was so upset earlier. And then kind of jumping into, you know, like what happened. And it can be, I don't want to say you want to make up a story, but it can be a slight white lie of just kind of thinking about, oh, the lady at the checkout counter, she didn't know that I had this coupon, and like whatever. And just kind of going through like where the breakdown was, how you responded to it. And then kind of letting it be that the story ends up kind of teaching a lesson in a way, or kind of just showing like the way, maybe it worked and maybe it didn't work. Maybe you're like, oh, I should have done this differently. Or now in retrospect, I wish I blah, 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 fill in the blank. That can be nice. And it might open up the door for the child or the student to share something that happened to them that was similar, taking off those like drilling of the questions, which I don't necessarily like. And another strategy I would say is, like, you're the parent and you can be, you know, you have the unconditional love for the person, and you can kind of be someone who might let them know if there is something that's coming out of being socially, like if you think there's something that's a big social like roadblock and you're noticing it, like you can tell the person. I don't think we have to be afraid of, you know, oh, we're just going to hurt the feelings, or it's going to be awkward, because if it's something that you're noticing, it might be helpful to bring it up. So you can be the person who might let them know, like, oh, when you're walking away from me and we're trying to talk, it's hard for me to hear you, and it makes me think you're not interested.
Yeah.
And then kind of like saying, is that true? Are you not, if you're not interested, that's okay. You don't have to be interested. But like, just so you know, when you're walking away, it shows me that you're not interested. And you might know as a parent that they're walking away because they want to like get a fidget to hold, and they are interested, but kind of letting them know, like, this is how it might be perceived.
Yeah.
So that they just are aware. And it doesn't mean that it's wrong. It's just, that's the way that a neurotypical person might perceive that. Unless you say something like, okay, I'm listening, but I'm going to go grab my pen while we're talking. And now it's like, oh, wow, look, now we understand. Like, now we're on the same page. And I think that type of thing can be powerful, because the person might not even know that they're coming off as not interested. Like, they might be really interested and they're like, oh, of course I'm, why wouldn't I be interested? And you're like, well, you were walking away from me. So kind of explicitly teaching some of those things. Do you have anything that comes to mind that you think would be helpful?
I mean, it's difficult for me to say because, the way I learned, like, to cope a lot was just being really pushy And so it's not something I recommend. You know, it's one of those things I'm unlearning.
One other thing for families that they could maybe do, so I can just add on, is that, you know, talking explicitly about the message you're providing and not using a lot of idioms and figurative language. But then if you do, making sure that you're also teaching it, because it's not obvious. So kind of thinking of, you know, like if I use a phrase that isn't familiar with a child, then saying, oh, what I meant was fill in what you meant, so that it's clear and that there's just an opportunity to learn a new phrase. Because sometimes this could be like, you might unintentionally confuse them and they might not know and they might not check in. So kind of thinking of like, how specific can I be? How explicit can I be? And then also I wouldn't advocate just like watering down everything and talking to them like they're younger. So if you do use a higher level phrase, then, you know, just explaining it, and talking about maybe the social connotation of something, because you don't want to accidentally have them, you know, saying something rude that they might not even realize is rude, because it's a phrase that they're not familiar with. If the parent wants a behavior to change, like the example I was thinking of is if, you know, a child is standing really close to you, instead of just being like, back off and like snapping, you know, the parent could say something like, you know, when you stand that close to me, it makes me feel uncomfortable because I like to have more space around me. Can you please move back? That you might have to be that clear, instead of just being like, if you're just pushing your hand away, the child might not have the nonverbal communication reception to know, oh, they're showing me to get away. So you might have to say it. Like, you might have to say things that you think are obvious, and they're not going to be obvious, but eventually it will become, like you said, eventually you'll learn them, and it's not going to be the rest of their life, but they might not know what you're flapping your hand away means when you're like, I've told you 7 times to get away. They might be like, wait, what? That was, you didn't say it once. So kind of just thinking of, you know, what have you actually said, and just over communicating maybe.
Yeah.
This is Jessica Murray again. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Steps to Autism Acceptance podcast. For links, bios, and more information on this episode, plus additional resources for autistic students transitioning to college, visit stairwaytostem.org. Again, thanks for listening, and keep tuning in.